Cordash versus the United States. Okay, Mr. Ginsburg.
May it please the court, my name is Peter Ginsburg on behalf of the appellant. Good morning. Respectfully, the district judge engaged in a flawed legal analysis that has had the consequence of depriving Mr. Cordash of his right to a jury to determine whether Customs and Border Patrol officers violated state common law, and indeed not only violated state common law, but violated objective standards promulgated by the agency. Mr. Cordash's complaint alleges, with detail, allegations of excessive force, threat of force, allegations of prolonged confinement without any justification, and without any law enforcement purpose. And those allegations constitute violations of legal standards and violations of government's promulgated standards.
Here's one of the issues that troubles me the most about this case, okay, for your argument. This is your second lawsuit.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the first lawsuit, you lost, and the issues on which you lost seem to me to be have collateral estoppel effect here. Collateral estoppel does not require mutuality. This isn't offensive, non-mutual collateral estoppel. This would be defensive collateral estoppel. Very settled that you could do that. And it seems that if you look at our precedent in Denson, the determination in the earlier suit that the officers were acting within their discretionary authority and did not violate federal law would seem then to bar, as I understand Denson, suits against the officers and their individual capacity. What am I missing?
Your Honor, Denson, I think, is the proper place to review whether there was or was not collateral estoppel. And of course, there are very prominent and, I believe, persuasive reasons why Denson, in fact, leads to the conclusion there is no res judicata. I mean, obviously, there
I'm not talking about res judicata. I'm talking about collateral estoppel.
Collateral estoppel. I apologize, Your Honor. First of all, the standards are quite different between a Bivens allegation and a Federal Tort Claims Act allegation. And what the judge in the lower court decided, and everything else is dicta, what the judge decided was that there were no objective constitutional standards by which the customs officers' activities could be measured.
What was decided in the earlier action was that there was no violation, and there was also there were alternative findings as well. And even if there had been, it wasn't clearly established. But it seemed to me that it was very clearly litigated that the officers were acting within their discretionary authority. That was determined in the earlier proceeding, wasn't it?
What was determined was the initial stop what constituted action within their authority.
I thought all of them were insofar as this individual was concerned, was litigated. Not true?
There was no analysis, Your Honor, of any actions after the initial stop. There was
the
nothing
stop,
that would...
Is the initial stop the September 23, 2017 stop?
Well, it's not just the September 23rd stop that constitutes the complaint. But
No, I'm asking when you say the initial stop, I'm just asking which
one. I apologize. The initial stop on each occasion.
Oh, I see.
One of the occasions involved 6 hours of detention and a falsified report by customs officers without any articulable factors justifying the interrogation, the taking of personal property, the cuffing of Mr. Kordash. Denson provides a three-part analysis, I think, to determine race judicata.
You mean collateral estoppel.
Collateral estoppel. Was the officer authorized? And again, we're not disputing that the officers were authorized to make the initial stop. What we're disputing is whether
everything the officers were doing was within their discretionary authority, right?
Respectfully, I think that's absolutely not correct, Your Honor. And I think Judge Pryor's decision in Swofford may provide a worthy analysis. And it wasn't Your Honor who wrote the opinion, but you were on the panel. That case involved whether when an officer takes possession of a vehicle and drives it, whether that initial decision is or is not a discretionary matter. And obviously the answer to that is yes. But Swofford makes clear that what that officer does.
But when you have someone coming in at the border and you stop them, you decide to detain them, you search them, the length of detention, all of those things are within the discretionary authority of a Customs and Border Patrol officer, aren't they?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The government
has. What specifically happened in any of these incidents that you do not think was within the discretionary authority?
The best way to analyze that, respectfully, Your Honor, is to look at the government's own objective standards of what is and isn't appropriate. Detention can be no longer.
That's a different question, Mr. Ginsburg. Whether they violated the standards, is a different question from whether that kind of detention and search is within their discretionary authority. That's what border officers do, isn't it?
What border officers do and what they're legally required to do is to exercise that discretion.
Okay.
Initially. But once the determination is made, once there are no articulable factors that could justify hour after hour after hour of interrogation, when there is not
that's a different argument.
An argument that they violated the Constitution, that what they did was unreasonable. But that may be, but that doesn't take them out of discretionary authority.
Discretionary authority, respectfully, Your Honor, only lasts as long as the activities are reasonable and within the duty of the officer.
Exercising your discretion poorly is different than not having discretion, isn't it?
Right, and that's why the government promulgates objective factors by which the actions can be measured and by which one can discern the difference between actions taken in his or her discretion and actions that go beyond that.
It seems to me that these rules guide the officers in exercising their discretion, but they don't eliminate their discretion.
Let me suggest this, Your Honor. If the officers were exercising their discretion, they would not have falsified their reports. They would not have purposely omitted pertinent information, such as the length of the stay, such as the taking of personal property, without any articulable law enforcement.
Mr. Ginsburg, that's just not the way the law works in this area. Every time an officer stops someone for a moving traffic violation, they exercise their discretionary authority. They may engage in an unreasonable search or seizure. They may engage in excessive force, but they're acting within their discretionary authority. So we get for qualified immunity purposes, we move then to the next step to determine whether there's a constitutional violation. If there's a violation of the Constitution, we don't say they're no longer exercising their discretionary authority. That's step one. We've already gotten past that. You see?
I do see, Your Honor. And here, since we're suing the United States, the question is...
You earlier sued the officers.
And the judge found that there was no objective constitutional standard. And the analysis that is applied in this case is different than the analysis, and some of the facts are different than what was considered in the first case.
So let's say we read the standards as specifically as you suggest. Section 4.1 states the detainees, quote, should generally not be held for longer than 72 hours in CBP hold rooms or holding facilities. So how does detaining Cordash for a limited number of hours fall outside that rule?
Because the 4.1 also says that the detention cannot be for any longer than is necessary. And in order to analyze whether the detention was necessary, we look at whether there were any articulable factors justifying the stay. We look at whether there was any law enforcement purpose. And the place to look is in the report, the officer's own reports. And there's not a scintilla of justification for doing what they did. And respectfully may provide another example. With regard to the stop of Mr. Cordash's friend, the woman from Sweden, the government passes that off by saying there's no standing. But in fact, that is evidence of the abuse. That is evidence of the fact that the officers had no law enforcement purpose.
Okay, Mr. Ginsburg, you've saved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Let's hear from Mr. Sturgill.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice representing the United States. The district court correctly dismissed all the complaints in this all the claims in this complaint for failure to state a claim, taking the allegations of the complaint as true. First of all, I want to, as our brief explains, the agents had statutory authority to conduct these searches under 31 U.S.C. 5317B, which allows customs officials to stop and search people at the international borders. This is important, without probable cause or reasonable suspicion. And as you know, the Supreme Court has held that lawful border searches do not require routine border searches do not require either reasonable cause or probable cause or reasonable suspicion.
I know you'll want to get back to this, and we will too, but first, in your view, did the United States raise collateral estoppel in the district court?
So in our briefs, we did refer to the district court's Bivens order, and we did refer to the similarities between that order and this case and the implications of it. I don't know that we said the words.
Here's what you said. You said that the first court dismissed the Bivens claim with prejudice. This case is arise out of an identical core of operative fact, and that the results from the Bivens case should control the outcome here. You didn't use the words collateral estoppel, but that's the sum, and that's it, right? That's everything you said, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and we think that's enough to preserve the question, but even if it's not, the court can affirm on any ground that's provided in the record, and collateral estoppel, for the reasons Chief Judge Pryor has noted, is plain on the plain as day on the face of this case. So, and we've argued in the opening brief, and the plaintiffs didn't respond to it at all in their reply brief, so I think you could even take it as conceded at this point. They don't have any answer to it here today. So that's one ground on which you could rule. Again, returning to the grounds the district court provided, the district court said that all of these searches were routine border searches, and routine border searches are lawful without either probable cause or reasonable suspicion.
Right, so and the question is whether this is a routine border search. And Is the length of time determinative, or does it have to be something about the nature of the detention or the search?
So primarily when the cases have found a non-routine search, they found that because of some kind of invasion of privacy. For example, a strip search is not a routine search. If the officers, and they don't do this, but if they were hypothetically to hold somebody for a long, long time and not let them have access to a bathroom or not provide them with food or water, that would be a non-routine search.
The Supreme Court has said that we look at whether a traveler arriving in the United States generally would, quote, expect to be detained for a particular length of time, end quote. How do we determine what length of time is to be expected at the border? Is that a question of fact?
So, first of all, Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Flores-Montano said that up to 2 hours of detention is to be expected at the border and is per se reasonable. So I think that provides a safe harbor of at least 2 hours. And that should take care of this case, because the district court in the Bivens ruling said that the two 2018 searches, which Mr. Kordash says lasted too long, one of them was for only 2 hours, and the other one was for 2.25 hours. So those should come within.
I thought one of them was 4 to 6 hours.
So that's what plaintiff alleges, but the district court in the Bivens case found that that one was only for 2 hours, and that's what the CBP report says. So that should be binding as a matter of collateral estoppel. Mr. Kordash actually litigated that question in the Bivens setting, and he lost, and he didn't appeal. Instead, he turned around and filed a new action under the FTCA as if the first action had never occurred. And if the,
let's suppose that collateral estoppel does not apply to that question. How do we determine whether 4 to 6 hours would be expected by a traveler entering the United States?
So the second guidepost is the Second Circuit's Tabah decision, which said that 6 hours is reasonable for a person entering the United States.
And well, that was different, though, because there was a vehicle search involved. They were coming by land across the border. Here, Mr. Kordash is flying into the country.
So, Your Honor, the Supreme Court hasn't given any kind of hard and fast rule for what is too long to be a reasonable border search. And I think so what that leaves you is a case-by-case determination. So, and then,
which leads back to my question, would that be a question of fact?
So it could be in an appropriate case, but in this case, it's not, because what you have is two searches in 2018, and you have a finding again. I know this gets back to the collateral estoppel, but that is part of our response, that these searches were found to be of 2 hours. 2 hours is within the safe harbor. Ergo, you don't have to decide the hard question, which is—
Right, but I think she's asking you to help her solve the hard question. So let's say we have to solve the hard question. How do we do that?
So the hard question is a case-by-case analysis.
Right.
And again,
for
I think—
For this case.
I'm sorry. So one guidepost we're offering is the Tabah decision from the Second Circuit, which said 6 hours is enough to be—it was within the safe harbor for a routine border search. And I think the other maybe helpful thing to think about is Chief Judge Pryor's opinion in the Doucette case, which explains kind of the purpose of all of this. And that is that when people leave the country and they come back to the United States, the United States' interest as a sovereign in searching the people who are coming up against, searching their belongings, finding out if they're doing anything illegal, is paramount. And so that's a unique setting.
We understand that, and that's a given, yeah. But then the question is, how long is too long? What is non-routine?
So I think it bears on that question, which is that the presumption is that, at least if you're within the six-hour rule of Tabah, then that should be, again, presumptively okay because of the government's compelling interests in, you know, protecting its borders. Now, maybe if it's 2 days or 72 hours, that's a different question. But again, I think these cases are best handled.
When we're looking at how to draw the line, doesn't it depend on the circumstances? Because in Tabah, the court said, this is a reasonable amount of time to conduct a vehicle search.
Well, it also called it a routine border search. And we know from this court's cases and from the Supreme Court's cases that routine border searches don't require any kind of reasonable suspicion at all. So you don't have to look at what the reasons are. And that's, again, a problem with their case. Their main argument for why this is a false arrest is that this was unjustified search. Well, reasonable searches don't require any kind of justification. So, but back to your question, I think, again, the prudent thing to do is not to reach out and try to set rules in this case for what the outer boundary could be in a situation where you've been given essentially beyond the 2 and 6 hour parameters we've given you. If it gets beyond that, it's case by case, and there aren't any really great guideposts for knowing what that is. So I would sort of hesitate to just jump in there and try to say something without better guideposts. Would be, that's the best response I think we can give you, and just try to decide this case.
Are you or are you not arguing for a bright line rule that up to 6 hours would be routine?
So we would say 6 hours is routine based on the Tabar case, yes.
Do you think it needs to be routine in order for these to survive, setting aside, again, collateral estoppel? Don't you think there were specific things that the border agents were concerned about?
So, yes, Your Honor, that's our second argument, which is actually, and it forgive me for getting back to collateral estoppel, but the district court in the Bivens case found that there was reasonable suspicion for all three of these searches, and that should be binding on Mr. Kordash as a matter of collateral estoppel. And you know the facts as well as I do, but in the first incident, it took longer than the 2 hours for the second ones because Mr. Kordash was found to have falsified currency reporting reports, substantially falsifying. He first said that he was carrying $6,000 with him, and then he scribbled that out and he wrote $12,000. And well, that he had found out he actually had $34,000. So people don't forget they're carrying $34,000 in their luggage. And the other thing is the CBP.
How much you have in the bank, maybe, I don't know.
That's a fair point. I wouldn't forget it anyway.
I wouldn't either.
On a government salary. But, you know, the CBP report also, this is important, notes that the way that money was put together. Basically, he had stacks of $100 bills that were had 20s wrapped around them, which clearly suggests that he was trying to conceal the money he was taking with him. So it took time for the CBP officials to work through this, right? They had to count the money. And this is not in the record, but I happen to know that the money counters, the electronic money counters, weren't working that day. So they actually find people to come in and sort out the money and count it and make sure it's counted properly. And he also had some Colombian pesos with him. They had to be counted.
But none of that was true for the February 2018 search, right? He wasn't carrying any money then.
So that's correct. And what the district court said was, at that point, first of all, 2 hours is presumptively reasonable as a border search. But in the Bivens case, the court said, well, there was reasonable suspicion for that one, too, because it was within a year and the CBP officials were working with a person who had just committed a currency violation. This is a criminal statute that he violated and a serious violation. This statute is important. The CBP uses it. The point of it is to be able to address and prevent, like, drug offenses and money laundering and international trafficking offenses. These are the highest level of importance to the government. So that's what happened in the first one. And again, if you get to the reasonable suspicion question, you don't have to, I think, even decide whether you think that was right or not. The district court in the Bivens case decided that there was reasonable suspicion for all three searches, and that should be binding on Mr. Kordash as a matter of collateral estoppel. If he didn't like that, he could have appealed instead of, like, filing a new suit.
Could have brought the Federal Tort Claims Act, you know, all together, as happened in Denson, too.
That's correct. So just a couple of things, and I'm not going to have time to get to all of the claims, but I do want to just say a few things. First of all, the standards for a Fourth Amendment false arrest claim and a Florida false imprisonment claim run the same, and that's the Lozman case, which is cited in our brief. So counsel's wrong to say there's some big difference between the Fourth Amendment false arrest claim that the district court addressed in the Bivens ruling and this Florida false imprisonment claim. Second, Chief Judge Pryor, you're right. The Bivens decision did actually twice specifically say that Mr. Kordash had failed to allege the violation of a constitutional right in addition to the qualified immunity ruling, and that was at pages 12 and 14 of the order. Third, I note that the complaint itself alleges that the CBP officials who conducted these searches were acting within the scope of their employment when they did that. And they, of course, they have to do that in order to be able to allege an FTCA suit. So that the plaintiffs themselves have taken the position that these individuals were acting to serve the purposes of the United States in doing that. The other sort of overall point is that we think Judge Carnes' concurring opinions in the Denson case is also another ground on which the court could reject all of the claims. As Judge Denson explained, under Florida law, there is...
Judge Carnes.
I'm
Judge
sorry. Thank
under
you.
Under Florida law, yeah, if you're acting with the governmental authority, that's a defense to the tort claim.
Right. So we think Judge Carnes was right about that, and that's... Now, the district court didn't say that, but again, you can... It said that on certain claims, but that applies to all the claims. So that's another sort of straightforward case way you could just affirm all the claims without getting into the, the elements of each one if you didn't want to. At this point, I don't have time to go through the elements of all the claims. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them, but in 40 seconds, I don't think it's worth starting out on that endeavor.
I'd cut you off if you did. Thank you,
Your Honor.
Virgil. Mr. Ginsburg, you've saved 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll ask you this question on my time. I would just want to make sure I understand because I couldn't quite tell from your briefs. Are you basing the false imprisonment claim on your September 23rd, 2017 detention or only the detentions from February 18th, 2018 and November 13th, 2018?
The latter, Your Honor.
Just the last two? The
latter.
Okay, thank you.
Let me suggest, since you've raised the September stop, there is a reason why the government gave all of the money back to Mr. Kordash. There is a reason why it was the government, and this is in the record, that insisted on a hold harmless letter. There was a reason why the government did not pursue Mr. Kordash. It's not in the record, but for counsel to present an argument that impugns the integrity and reputation of my client based on that stop, ignores
your,
what really
your client
happened.
Was fined $2,500, right?
We agreed to pay administrative costs.
It was $2,500 fine.
Yes, Your Honor, the administrative costs that were itemized by the government. I don't know why it cost them $2,500 to administer.
But your client paid that.
Yes, Your Honor. And the government gave back all of the rest of the money. And the government didn't pursue or prosecute Mr. Kordash. And there obviously is a law enforcement reason for that. Now, with regard to how to draw the line, that's what juries are for.
To draw what? To draw what line?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
To which line are you referring?
I'm sorry, the line of the appropriate duration and actions during that duration. This wasn't a couple-hour stop. There was a three-hour stop. There was a six-hour stop, and counsel ignores. There was a 24-hour stop. When a friend of Mr. Kordash...
You understand that initially that's a legal determination, that there's a determination about what is routine versus non-routine that a court makes.
That's right.
Not that a jury makes.
Correct. But as Butts in the United States Supreme Court said, officers under any circumstances may not with impunity ignore the limitations that are placed on them by controlling law. And those limitations are placed by the government's own national standards and by state common law. Remember, there's a 24-hour stop here, which the government wants to continue to ignore. But during that 24-hour stop, the government officers said that Mr. Kordash was importing women for prostitution, that he was about to be arrested, that he was laundering money, and went on and on. The reports don't reflect that kind of abuse. But there is no way the 24-hour abuse of Mr. Kordash's friend can be rationalized. And there's no way that the government can rationalize that this was not something that evidences that Mr. Kordash was being targeted. And I suggest the record shows that he was being targeted because he dared to challenge the government and its claims relating to the September 23rd incident. And it was the government that backed away and folded its tents on that occasion. And this, I think the record suggests, all of the prolonged stops, all of the detention, the cuffing, the taking of personal property, the abuse, was punitive measures by the government. As one of the officers said to Mr. Kordash, you have a bullseye on your head. We're going to do this to you every time you come into the United States. That's not a discretionary function. That's not a law enforcement purpose. And that abuse is not set forth in the government reports, which they have a legal obligation to render accurately and fairly. That's what a jury should determine, the motives and the actions.
Thank you. We have your argument. We're going to move to the last case.
Thank you, Your Honor.